the sort of conclusions that emerge.
But
all the subtlety,
that give and take then often, it disappears, but it goes, even though the chairman is a dominating figure, he has to, and in any one meeting, if he wanted to, he could say, look, I need your help, this is a difficult time, but he can't do that.
Kind of goodwill very often.
That's right. So there's this subtle interplay between the chairman and the members of the committee where they reach a consensus, and that's part of the fascination of the game. And
that's right. And then around that represents some of the things that are done before the meeting, there's almost an unwritten law that most of the time in that pre-FOMC meeting days, you don't go and no governor goes, and even the chairman goes to try to really sell. You got to get a guy to change his vote, but that's a little improper. But it's on the other hand. Some days, they're going to be divided, and it's important. And the subtleties with which I was sent down that hall a few times to say something or to learn something from a governor that would help either the chairman or another governor do it. But all the sort of set of ethical constraints and how far I could go. And that's not in print anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think probably other secretaries of the FOMC have had the same experience. Chatting I've done with Ralph Young, I certainly have a sense of that. From time to time, he did that kind of thing with Bill Martin. But again, it's not lobbying. It's a very careful, subtle thing with among sophisticated, knowledgeable people, how you try to prepare to get to developing a consensus. I thought if I ever wrote a book or wrote an article, I would write an article on a consensus building in the FOMC. I think that's the most underappreciated aspect of the functioning of monetary policy.
Yeah. Let me try something controversial out on you, because I wouldn't know quite how to say it publicly. I wouldn't, but... I think when any chairman goes into an FOMC meeting, he knows how the vote for that meeting is going to come out. Practically, I'm not always, but pretty much. And the reason is that when he talks to the Secretary of the Treasury on Monday, they've talked over what they think is going to happen, and the chairman doesn't want to blindside the administration and kind of catch them by surprise. So a chairman has, before the FOMC meeting, he's talked to the most articulate governors. He certainly talked with the vice chairman, the president of the New York Fed. There are usually several presidents who are insiders who never dissent, but feel like they get some inside advantage of discussing with the chairman. So the chairman has an idea of how the meeting's gonna come out. Now, I don't want to exaggerate that, because sometimes there's definitely tension there, and the chairman...
I think it varies from one meeting to the next.
What I'm saying is
the certainty the chairman has how the meeting is likely to turn out. Some meetings... are in the middle of a kind of pattern or trend of monetary policy making, where it's clear how the votes are going to go, because nothing important is controversial or at stake. There may be one dissident president, but you can afford that, you know.
Yeah, I may be exaggerating, but I have a feeling that often the key governors are arguing not just for the current meeting, but for the subsequent meeting. That is, they're not going to dissent at that particular meeting because the chairman's talked to them. He understands their views. He respects them. But they're making their case so that, you know, the chairman knows that he can get a consensus that meeting without any kind of a split. They're making their arguments, and the chairman's got to take account of those for the next meeting. There really is often arguing for the next meeting as much as the current meeting.
Oh, sure, but I think you're describing it at least in my experience in the time internet. I wouldn't give him quite that credit of that much certainty.
Yeah.
Or I wouldn't give him a credit for quite that much clear-cut communication between the various governors. At least that's the way it seemed to me. I was a little when I first was down there and began to see that, I was first a little puzzled at how little communication there was governor to governor and chairman to governor. Even over their luncheon tables and so forth. After I got into more of the inner processes, I realized, yes, there was more than I had seen and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But it was subtle. I mean, it was only once in a while would some governor sort of try to make a case, and usually it would be to another governor.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened, I think, most often when we had a lot of economists on the board. I can remember Sherman Mazel trying to persuade George Mitchell, and Mitchell thought Mazel was off the rails. But Mazel's style was really out of keeping with sort of the tradition of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even George Mitchell, who was more outspoken than the average governor, seldom would push that hard.
Mm-hmm.
They were respectful of one another. There was a sense that lobbying one another wasn't really like kosher. I mean, it's not quite in keeping with the.
Oh, absolutely.
Organization, yeah.
The FOMC wouldn't work if people went in with blocks.
Yeah.
And it would be like negotiating in the Balkans or something. You wouldn't get a consensus. Have divisions.
Well, a little bit like the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Not exactly, but a little bit in that respect in terms of how there's some communications back and forth. In some of their non-monetary assignments, they'll write the memos to had the staff write something on that area. But in monetary policy, it was, you know, I had one governor, the governor for several years, asked me to come in and listen to him and visit with him in sort of the week before the next coming FOMC, and to give him, and then after we've talked, to capture in black and white the kind of statement it would be appropriate for him to make to the committee.
Was that Governor Robertson?
Yeah.
I mean,
once in a while, another governor or two would ask me to do it, but Robbie was the one that asked me most consistently.
Yeah, he
he was careful. He never showed that to anybody else.
Is it fair to say that over time he changed? From, I know this is an exaggeration, but from being something of a populist to being an inflation hawk, by the end of his career, he seemed to me sort of all the prior traces that maybe I was kind of reading into it of his concern for interest rates and as opposed to inflation, that had all disappeared. And he was very clearly an inflation hawk.
As it went along, we increasingly saw emerging some of the damages inflation could do. Moreover, we also were getting impressions of, you know, how strong monetary policy was in dealing with the inflation. And, I won't say got out of hand, but it sure got bigger than we wanted, even before the Volcker era, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, every chairman that both Martin and Burns, at the end of their term of service as chairman, felt that they had failed in letting inflation to get further than it should have gone. That with 2020 hindsight, it would have been better if they'd been tougher earlier, that kind of thing and so forth.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about Martin in a minute, but let me just ask you about Burns.
And I feel that way.
Did Burns really leave with regrets? He had so much self-assurance, and he always thought that a lot of the inflation was coming from cost-push pressures from militant labor movements. Do you really think he ended with any regrets? I mean, this is a guy with just incredible self-assurance that he was doing the right thing.
But we had, there was more inflation going on than he regarded as desirable for the economy from the position of 2020 hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was just what people say. He was too sensitive to the disruptive effects of interest rate increases, before the fact. After the fact, he would have, like Volcker, he would have been much less concerned about what, say, the disruptive effects of interest rate increases on financial markets.
Well, that's putting it sort of in an extreme term, but you've caught what I think is the spirit of what I'm trying to convey, you know, that the, looking back with 2020 hindsight, he would rather have had less inflation and incurred the pains of more monetary tightening.
Hmm.
Not a huge amount, but we didn't quite pull it down. He didn't quite pull it down as much as he would like.
Did you ever have any conversations with Burns after he left the chairmanship?
No.
Yeah. But it's sort of hard to talk about individuals. Volcker was...
Martin was very outspoken. Remember that piece in that little book that we wrote about him, that he got the governors together at about the end of his term and just said flatly, I've failed. Inflation has gone too far. Then I believe is right.
Okay.
And they all tried to talk him out of it, saying, gee whiz, Bill, you can't, you couldn't have done everything. I mean, we were bucking a lot of winds and resistances and threats and everything else. We tried as hard as we thought we could and still be allowed to be an ongoing organization with people like us in it. I mean, we thought we'd push much harder, Patman, I'll get a bill passed that'll, cut the Fed up in pieces or tie us up in knots and so forth. We really felt constrained because of the threat of what a congressman fired by a Patman or one or two of those other guys over there who were a little more sophisticated than Patman but still wanted to take a chunk out of us, you know.
Yeah, well, Proxmire and Royce were really... They were formidable adversaries.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. And
they were smart.
so we were, we didn't define that much as a constraint. But boy, it was, and everybody in that room knew it. We tended to use different kinds of words in the minutes, you know, words that are a little more polite and that kind of thing. But that was certainly a constraint.
I want to.
Terms, you've got it painted about right. The Martin welcomed Mitchell as a governor.
Mm-hmm.
Glad to have George there. He regarded George as somebody who would really call a spade. Well, first place, a smart economist, a person who really call a spade a spade. Who never stab him in the back or anything, and I get that he could really count on George, and who tries to think straight.
Yeah.
So he saw all that was a gain. And plus, which I think the two just liked one another. Mitchell felt one of the things that needed to be done was for the gap between, let me go way back, the gap between the Fed and academia to be narrowed.
Mm-hmm.
Not in terms necessarily of positions, but certainly in terms of communication. And he came up with this idea of having that group that put together for him once or twice a year, of really outstanding economists coming in and meeting and talking to the board informally.
Yeah, the academics consultant group.
Yeah, that was really George's idea. He saw the gap. He thought there ought to be more communication so that mm-hmm. each side could understand more of the nuances and what the other side had to contribute. He thought if each of the sides understood better, they'd work together better, things would go better, and so forth. And once in a while, he'd say to me something like, we gotta get across some of this new economics
mm-hmm.
to the board. Well, and he once in a while he'd say to Bill, he'd say, he really meant to be talking about the. Not the classic Keynesian, but about the kind of Bob Solow style about growth, and this business of underused resources, and that the problem is really when you use up your underused resources, then the inflation power really hits, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That appealed to George, mm-hmm. and he thought it was good for the other governors to hear that discussed. Mm-hmm. Couldn't say, I think that's right and everything else is wrong. But he said, I think this is stuff we need to take into account. We need to expose the chairman to, and all the members of the board and so forth.
He came out of the Chicago and had some support from the Democratic Party in Chicago.
Yeah.
There was some.
Yeah, well, remember, he had been, he was a Democrat who wouldn't act like a Democrat. He was trained as a fiscal expert, and that's what he was doing at the Fed. But remember, Bill Daley came to the Fed and asked for some fiscal help, in the sense of advice, his expertise, and in running the mayor's operation.
Who came to Mitchell?
Mitchell.
Okay.
He wanted to borrow Mitchell as an advisor, and I think, I don't know how formal that ever got, but for a while Mitchell was advising the mayor on the fiscal side of how to get better control and handle better. That was his intellectual expertise, you see.
Like Rivlin and control
board. Yeah, and Daley knew that Mitchell was straight as a string. And he said, that's why I want him. Want one straight as a string, absolutely honest and integrated,
mm-hmm.
in here helping me to deal with Bill. So Daley, for all the talk about it, he's a big political guy, does all kinds of things. He wanted Mitchell's integrity, and he never tried to override Mitchell on that kind of score. Well, Mitchell was giving him advice, so he could ignore Mitchell's advice. But he treated George respectfully, see?
And he
was going through a time of particularly tough financial stuff for the city. And some of what George told him was helpful enough to help him work out of it, and Daley was really grateful. So, later on, in the evolution of the Democratic Party back there, Adlai Stevenson comes into the picture and wins the governorship of Illinois. And when Daley sees him in all the celebration gatherings of the Democrats about taking over the country, he says, "Mr. Stevenson, if you ever have," or governor, he called him, you know, "if you ever have need for some financial help to run your, that operation, right, I can sure tell you a guy who can do it, because he did it for me." That's this guy, George Mitchell, up at the Fed. And that's how Stevenson heard about Mitchell. And Stevenson began to see, hey, in this Illinois government, there's a lot of problems. I don't want to say corrupt, but it was just problems.
Yeah, well, it was.
So he called up, and he asked the president of the Fed, "Will you lend me George?" And in that for a while. And in that case, there was a formal arrangement, and Mitchell went down and was the budget director for Adlai Stevenson for a while.
When did Mitchell begin his association with the Fed? It wasn't when he became governor in 61?
Oh, no.
Okay, that I just didn't know.
No. Mitchell went to school, graduate school up in Wisconsin. He was teaching fiscal policy in the University of Wisconsin, I believe.
Oh, wow.
When the Fed wanted to add to its own research department in Chicago some more strength on the fiscal side. And so, I don't know, somewhere they heard about John Langham was running the research department at the Fed at the time. And he was one of these guys who had an eye for a good talent and ways of sort of persuading. He was really good at that kind of thing. And if I tell you how good, let me tell you who he hired at one time or another in that Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago research department. He hired three different people that became governors of the Federal Reserve Board. He hired, one who became a president of the Federal Reserve Bank, one who became the president of Fannie Mae, one who was the top economist for not only his own corporation, but sort of that national organization of economists who made forecasts. He picked them all out, one after another, and hired them. You know, well, that's a pretty damn good batting average, don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and he picked up George, see. I don't know where John talked about, but he had a nose for that kind of thing. He was just a really good recruiter and that kind of thing of talent. So he picked up George and brought George down to be his researcher for fiscal policy. And then when George was, and that started it, see? And so George was in that kind of activity. And then Adlai Stevenson asked to borrow him for summer, and then on we go to where we were before. But that's how we got there.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. His wife, Mary Mitchell, is, at my urgings, now working on a fairly extensive biography of George Mitchell. Because I think he's the kind of guy who played the kind of roles in various places that really made a difference in American society. And she's plugging right along. She sends me a draft every time she gets a chapter done. And it's she's doing well.
I'd like to talk to her. Do you have her phone number?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Now, her name's Mary Mitchell now. But this is quite a deal. She was the statistician in the research, a statistician in the research department of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago when George was brought in by Langen. So she worked there for a while under George. Well, for, as a matter of fact, I came in and some of that new blood brought, Langen brought in. For a while, she worked for me. And then I got promoted into the discount window and went off to Washington, D.C. But lo and behold, here later along, comes George down to be governor. And by that time, he was having divorce problems with his wife. She was a real Herod. Oh, man, I know her well. I would sometimes take stuff that George had asked me to write to where he was someplace with the family. She was tough to take. Maybe change her life or something, really change what she was like, but she was tough. And eventually they got divorced. George came down and was a governor. But we'll go back to Chicago occasionally. He had family back there, friends back there, and so forth. And he started to date Mary after he was out of the Fed of Chicago and even the board and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
She at that time had been, had gotten divorced too from one with a nasty, unhappy situation. And they began to date one another, and eventually he married her. Then she came to Washington. She's a good statistician, and she wanted to work. Each of them had children, but they were all grown up in a way, so theirs was a mature home. The FDIC wanted a statistician to produce some statistical discipline, and all those sort of examiners over there that worked a lot more on qualitative and quantitative deals. So she took the job, and she was a mid-level person at FDIC. Statisticians didn't stand very high at the time she was brought in. But the guy who was the head of FDIC at that time really wanted to get some more statistical discipline into the way they were handling examinations and dealing with them and analyzing them and so forth. He was right. They needed something in that direction. So she really ended up being kind of breaking a glass ceiling in terms of getting moved up gradually into more and more responsibility for the analysis of the examination things, creating the systems to how to analyze them, what kinds of statistical data to get in order to, you know, focus into these various problems. All in a situation where most of the people who were above her were male and didn't think women knew that much, you know.
Yeah.
They also didn't think statisticians knew that much about examination.
Mm.
But they were sort of, she was really bucking a double bias.
Hmm.
But she has a real nice, quiet way about it. And doesn't handle all this kind of stuff as a threat. And the top guys at the FDIC appreciated what she was doing and the way she was bringing it along. And she eventually ended up with a fairly high job that was sort of put her over the examiners in terms of creating these analytical things and so forth. All that was going on with her over there while George was doing what he was doing at the Fed. And she continued to work for the FDIC even after George died. Well, no, I guess he needed enough care, I believe, so that she stepped down from the FDIC. I think that's the way it went, yeah. But I tell you all this background because Mary is a special person. And she, even with all this background, Mary has a streak of modesty in her it's nice to see, but it also leaves her, if you were just to call her up and ask her questions, very polite kind of way, encourage her to be more forthcoming, more forthcoming, more forthcoming, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
She'll say, well, I really didn't know that, or I didn't know that. That's true in a way, but she also, you know, she and George were very careful about keeping the what they knew at the Fed and what they did at the FDIC separate.
Mm-hmm.
They were very aware that they didn't want that to become an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So Mary knew she didn't know that much about monetary policy, so she wasn't. She had her hands full, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's no dummy, and so
as
they lived along, she picked up some knowledge too. And she's got a lot of these papers and is using them now in developing this book, so she's got a big reservoir to draw on.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. In terms of Mitchell's interest in making monetary policy with procedures that were understandable to academics. I mean, Maisel had some of the same ideas, right? But Maisel didn't have the same sort of give and take that Mitchell had. He was a more abrasive, you know, this is my way, this is sort of thing. So he didn't have the same kind of way of getting other people sort of on board.
That's right.
In that way, he was less effective. But so in terms of the development of the Green Book, I mean, Martin was skeptical of forecasting exercises, but he was willing at the end of 65, and then as the 60s went on, to let the board staff develop a forecasting quantitative unit.
Now, all that happened
with Mitchell or Maisel?
Look careful. No. Sherm, you know, Sherm never had an idea he couldn't oversell somebody he's talking to. Mitchell handled all this very well. Mitchell understood the way the Federal Reserve System worked.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked on these kind of things, bringing in the academics, but in a way that didn't lead the academics blasting the governors and so forth on the one hand or back on the other. Mitchell handled that very nicely, and so did Lee Bach. They were both very careful about that. That's just one of the things Mitchell brought in this. And that was one of the ways, indirectly, he began to bring in some of these ideas about you can call it the new economics, the growth economics, the... It's sort of Keynesian plus, I think. I don't like to call it just Keynesian, as I look at it. So.
Sure.
The Fed had in its research department some guys who really wanted to go to push forward with that. Dan Brill, Lyle Gramley, who else was down there? There was a guy who was into Fed funds, a flow of funds up to his ears. I'll remember his name. And so forth. And particularly Dan wanted to try to make the Green Book more useful and more disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to use the economic models to do it. Models were, you know, we're around quite a bit that stage of the game. Dan knew Art Oaken very well.
Hmm.
And Art was over, Brookings, I think, for at least a good part of this time. Then, of course, he went into the Council of Economic Advisors.
Mm-hmm.
But Art was, Art struck Dan as one of, what I'll say, the most honest of the economists in this new area. That Art never told you what his results were without telling you if there was anything on the other side, like some problems.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan liked that. So Dan began to increasingly beef up the Green Book in terms of forecasting. And he had more stuff behind him. He had guys who really could build models and forecast him. He got in Jim Oh, jeez. Jim. I forgot it. I'll think of it. But anyway.
Yeah, Doisenberry or?
No, that you're thinking of the professor.
Yeah.
No, he. This is a guy that Dan hired, I think, right out of Berkeley, who had a lot of.
Jim Pierce?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah, no. And Jim had a lot of fire in this kind of thing. And,
oh, yeah.
And stoked him up, you know.
Yeah.
And Lyle Gramley was in there by that time. And he wanted to get in there, too, and that kind of stuff. Chuck Partee was coming along,
mm-hmm.
quite as big into the sort of the mathematics of those models, but boy, he was sure, he sure helped to, you know, make everything fit together. George was encouraging him to beat the band, Mitchell.
Yeah.
He didn't tell him what to do. He wanted the knowledge that could be distilled from this newer kind of way of looking at the economy. Mm-hmm. To be there to be used as one of the tools for deciding monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
He knew it wasn't going to be the whole sentence solution, no. But he knew it was better. But by that time, monetarism was also had some real advocates. And mm-hmm. George said, "Boy, that ain't right. This other system is better."
Mm-hmm.
George, again, to be fair, Ian Lee would invite in monetarists to this mm-hmm. academic discussion group from time to time. He was demonstrating and providing to the governors mm-hmm. A fair sample of the best of monetary policy and economic growth thinking, even if some of it was stuff he disagreed with.
Mm-hmm.
Both he and Lee were really bearcats that they wanted to have a fair appreciation. And whenever if there was an academic who came in who put on a show, you know,
mm-hmm.
To the governors, they didn't like it, and they wouldn't criticize that academic to his face. Mm-hmm. Boy, they'd drop him out of the picture.
Yeah.
All of that is brewing and changing gradually the content and the acceptability of the content in the Green Book.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got really a little fancier. We began to Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
Shorter times of not just forecasting and models and that kind of other thing, to put in the Blue Book those short-term forecasts of, you know, what would happen if you, you know, cut the rate so much, what would happen if you dropped it so much, what would happen if you stayed with current policy. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and by that time, the old guard of Young and Riefler and Thompson were gone.
Yeah.
And there was a new trucker. They called us a trucker. Dan and me and Bob Solomon over in the international division. And the board gave us quite a bit of leeway. Dan was pushing hard in this direction. I was plotting them and doing my side on that kind of thing. By that time, I think I was secretary of the FOMC.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob was running the international. And the board seemed satisfied with the way we were going things and that this was developing. And so it gradually unfolded into a more and more, I think I can fairly say, sophisticated type of analysis that isn't tied to a single theory of how monetary policy
mm-hmm.
affects the economy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The occasionally one or another of the governors who had some economics background, Maisel or Bremer, would argue with Dan about one of the things, or would ask for some staff to work with him on one of those things. But director of the research division on the board and the chairman and me too. I had the job by that time, I think, of executive director of the staff. We were selfish about that talent. We didn't let individual governors borrow a lot to get off and get on their own research. That made Maisel and Bremer mad. But we thought, frankly, we needed them. We needed that staff to work on what we were building, of a framework for analyzing and getting into monetary policy in an increasingly modernized kind of way.
Can I ask you some questions about things that I pulled out that have your name on them one way or the other? Apparently, at one time, you went around and gave some speeches to the directors at the regional banks like Richmond, and you talked in a general way about chairmen and their relations with Congress and so on. Do you remember that? I have some notes from that.
Well, I've got to really think to remember. That's right. I did do some of that kind of stuff. I wasn't so much the selector of the subject. I talked to Church. I talked a little bit to the chairman. I talked to. Who else was I dealing with on that kind of thing? I said, you know, I think we need to work on improving the relationship between the board and the Federal Reserve Banks. Mm-hmm. And between I think we've got research and knowledge here and so forth. We're sitting on. I think we ought to share some of this and the experience. I think we ought to share some of this with the Reserve Banks and, you know, the chairman and Martin in particular had been interested in who became the directors of the regional Federal Reserve Banks. He saw that, too, as an important way of them as an important part of keeping the Federal Reserve liked and respected inside the country, that if you have good directors on those reserve banks. And he liked to do things for them. He'd have new directors come down, and he'd talk to them, that kind of thing, and so forth.
Yeah, the chairman still does that.
That's really Bill Martin, you know.
Yeah.
And I felt the same way about this, that there wasn't nearly enough cooperation, really, between the two organizations. There wasn't an optimal amount of cooperation and sharing back and forth one way and another and so forth. And I shot off my mouth on that a few times in various circumstances with some encouragement from, let's see, who was chairman then?
What year is this?
I don't know. I just remembered I did it for a while. It's either late Martin or early Burns.
Early Burns. Yeah, because I got this memo here. It says, attaches an outline of remarks I made to the joint meeting of the boards of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond and its Charlotte branch.
Yeah.
Aubrey Heffern was so delighted with this subject that he's encouraging the other presidents to invite me out to their board meetings to make similar remarks.
Yeah.
Look, I'm just curious.
How did I find that subject that I talked about?
Well, you were talking about the Fed's relationship with the rest of the government and Congress and administration.
Okay, well, that was just me. It was my idea to try to improve more communication at various levels. And when I had somebody say, yes, let's do it, like Aubrey did, or other person did. Burns warmed to this idea as time went on. That is, this business of improving the Federal Reserve Bank relationships. I have never said so publicly, but I think, you know, I've said more than once inside the Federal Reserve System, you know, that this Federal Reserve System we got is a wonderful system. It's got checks and balances. to help all the various kinds of considerations being taken into account and so forth. But as a consequence, it's a very inefficient organization. It's structured with so many things. We need to work on making it. And I don't want to be a big a reformer. I just want to oil the wheels so they work better. And that was a line I used for a number of years. Not only did I go out and give speeches at some of these Reserve Bank directives and so forth, I also began to look around the system for really hotshot young up-and-coming officers who looked like they might have the capacity to become a first vice president or a president someday or something like that. And I would borrow from the, I'd call up the president and say, by that time I was pretty well running the staff and other things. Create the banking markets unit. I want to see if we can't do something more with the examination reports and so forth. And you've got so and so in your office. I know he's a fine up and coming person. Wouldn't it be good training and development for him to come down and spend, say, 6 months at the Fed, at the board, work as my lieutenant, so I'd get him into all the places, and I'd use him on this kind of problem I'm concerned with, and he learns a lot about how it works, and he comes back, and I never got turned down, and I borrowed one guy after another from one Reserve Bank after another while I was still there to do that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at these notes here that you gave on your speech. You've never said anything to me about Eccles, and you've got a number of comments here about him. Eccles, Roosevelt, good idea man, courageous, aggressive. Did you? I mean, Eccles would have been gone by the time you came into the
system.
Right?
That's what I learned from the graduate courses on money and banking and Wharton School.
Oh, I see.
And one of the guys who taught that course up there was a guy named Carl Bope, who was then the vice president for research at the Fed of Philadelphia, and was was a wonderful teacher.
Yeah, he's a, he was a mentor for Charlie Walker.
Yeah, he was a mentor for me, too.
And
Charlie and I and several others were in a group that really clung around Bope and learned from him.
So
what I knew about Eccles, I got from Bope. Well, and the professor who taught those advanced courses in finance and money and banking was also a whiz. His name was Whittlesey.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and between Whittlesey and Bope, boy, I got a lot of input on the Federal Reserve, and they both had quite a lot to say about Eccles. And I had all that under my belt by the time I was hired to go in the Federal Reserve System. One of the reasons I got ahead so fast, because I'd learned so much about the Federal Reserve System and how it operates, and even criticisms of what might needed to be changed from those two guys, who were just about as sharp as anybody I knew in terms of the Federal Reserve System and how it works and what its strengths and weaknesses are.
Wharton must have played an important role, because Balderston was chairman of the Wharton department, right?
Before he was the dean.
The dean,
yeah.
And so, I don't know this for a fact, but it just has to be the case that it was Balderston that got Riefler together with McCabe. Because my understanding is that McCabe went to Washington under the condition that Riefler would go with him as his advisor.
No, I think it's Bope would go with him. He took Bope with him. Now, he may have grabbed Riefler, too. I don't know.
Bope at this time had become director of research at the Philadelphia Fed.
He did that while he was still teaching. I mean, that was he was an adjunct teacher. Yeah. Bope was McCabe really liked Bope, because McCabe at that stage, I think, was chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Directors of the Fed.
Yeah.
And he'd hear Bope make these presentations, each time the board met, the directors met, and he really trusted Bope. So he took Bope down with him. Now, Riefler, I think McCabe depended a lot on Riefler too. In fact, I think Volpe was a fan of Riefler's, I believe. I mean, they knew each other.
That had to have been the case.
Yeah, and that I think is what is the way that went.
Yeah, yeah. See, this is a little scattered. I'm just looking through these various memoranda. There's some memoranda here from you to Arthur Burns, and the memoranda sort of make it clear that you were a defender of the rights of people to speak their mind. Here's a memo where you're defending St. Louis and Daryl Francis and his speeches. Burns may have been a little bit concerned.
I just tried to calm. Well, you can read it.
Yeah, it
I
says.
To calm him down.
You say, I think he's entitled to say that. These are reasonable statements.
It didn't make Burns very happy, but it did calm him down. I figured that fits in with the role I saw for myself of helping the oiling the wheels of the workings of the Federal Reserve System. You know, and if a chairman tries to order presidents or, you know, complain about what they say, or Arthur at one stage says, let's get Francis to send these speeches in here before he gives them and so forth. And I said, Mr. Chairman, that's asking for a lot of trouble. I said, you know, the Federal Reserve System has a dimension of check and balance for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Shut up, these presidents. I use whatever arguments I could use.
This is a memo that's. I'm wondering if you remember it. This is a memo that you wrote to Howard Hackley. It's September 27, 1972. So it would have been a month before the elections. And you said in it. That you would like him to write a memorandum regarding the power of the president to remove the chairman or vice chairman of the board. The implication of present law seems to be that once the chairman is designated by the president, he continues to serve as such for a period of 4 years without being subject to removal by the president. So Peter Flanagan or one of Nixon's people must have brought this subject up right before the elections. Burns must have felt like he was under some threat. Somebody must have said something.
I think that's right, but I don't quite remember. I don't remember the context. I remember my asking for that because Burns wanted to know that. But I don't remember from where the picture came, but it probably came from, you know, those guys up in the Flanagans over there were pretty unrestrained in terms of trying to push us around from time to time.
Yeah, I gather there was a very different. I mean, there was an unusual mix of people. People like McCracken and Stein and Schultz, and they were absolutely first class. But others were a little rougher. I assume Flanagan came in and fumed around.
It was probably Flanagan rattling a cage or something and trying to get Burns to do something or say something or not do something.
Yeah.
And he ruffled Burns' feathers and maybe even his security enough for Burns to say, what could they do to me, you know?
Yeah, Burns may have wanted to rattle back and say, look, you know, I'm say what you want, but I'm, you know, the Fed's independent. If you want to ask Congress to impeach me, that's fine, but there's no, that's...
I think you and I are guessing right on why it was asked, the information was asked for, but I don't know who did the cage rattling that led Arthur to... Arthur was a pistol when it came on backs on something. If something developed that concerned him, some subjugation, he wanted the facts, man. You know,
mm-hmm.
and he wouldn't just take anybody's on an issue like that. It was pure Burns. Get me a memo from Hackley, who was our top lawyer on this issue. You know? Give me the facts, that kind of thing.
How did you get involved in the Holland Subcommittee on the Directive? That was very interesting to me when I got here in 75. I read all of those memos. I thought they were really very, very thoughtful and very interesting.
Boy, you got to help me a little bit in terms of memory.
Well, there was an ongoing series of committees. Maisel was involved in them. There was the credit proxy, that would have been the first, but mostly they had to do, as time went on, with what the instrument ought to be, whether we could have reserve aggregate targeting or interest rate targeting, and then and that would have been the Maisel committee. But then there was a Holland committee on the directive, and there was quite a bit of interesting work. I remember Mike Kieran talking about it. These finally came before the board in February or March of 1976. And initially the proposals were quite ambitious. Kaltzbrenner was working on it, and Tinsley especially.
Yeah.
And as a ways of structuring FOMC decision making, to get the FOMC to be more explicit about its directives, and then given that explicitness, to have the board staff use its models to generate funds rate paths that would give you a path over time rather than a particular
value,
period by period.
Yeah.
Tinsley and Kaltzbrenner were the ones who did a lot of work on this. This was a time of optimal control, the idea that you could use models to kind of iteratively kind of go back and forth between misses in your targets and how you change the funds rate. Do you remember any of those discussions and how they finally ended up?
Vaguely. I'll need a lot of help to do it, to respond to it anyway. I do remember what was coming along here was as the research department developed, more and more trustworthy models and shapes like that and so forth, and on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're presenting them in the Green Book and in presentations like that and so forth. Dan and I thought we ought to try to bring some of that sophistication into the Blue Book. As I recall, the Blue Book already existed, but it's for that up-close look at the market and so forth. But now, I'm not sure, but this is my comment. I believe the Blue Book already existed, but the ranges of possibilities were not professionally developed. I guess that's what I would say. We're not rigorously developed. It was, it would be what the open market manager in New York thought and what I thought. And let's see, was Steve Axel not there by that time?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
You know, it was... what do we think what do we think the ranges here would be sensible, and not only in terms of the external pressures on the economy and the markets, but also in terms of the internal pressures within the FOMC of how much range they tolerate, or we didn't want to come up with a range of of 3 points in the Fed funds rate, when we know from the discussions around the table that the governors and the presidents are eager for narrower bands than that if they can get them, that kind of thing, see?
Yeah.
So we were trying to build in this greater sophistication. As you say, Tinsley and others are working on it, and we were drawn on that to gradually stiffen up, I guess is what I would say, the projections that were in the Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big fan at that stage. In general, when I was working inside the Federal Reserve, I would say, look, I tend to have an attitude. If we find something that represents a new area or a new subject or a new way of looking at things, let's don't wait until we get it perfected before we show it to the FOMC.
Mm-hmm.
They need more help than that, is what I used to say. And I say, well, let's begin to feed it in bit by bit. That kind of thing. And then we can learn from how they react to it and how the things work out. I mean, we can be an interactive kind of learning process,
mm-hmm.
instead of the staff holding on to it until it gets everything exactly right, and then, boom, it goes into the Blue Book. That was my way of, in effect, marketing ideas inside the Federal Reserve System.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what the Holland Committee was trying to do.
I think I'm going to let you go for lunch. I just have a couple more questions about your appointment to governor. So you replaced Governor Robertson. That was interesting.
Yeah.
So were you from Kansas? How did that happen?
I'm from Nebraska.
Nebraska, I mean.
Yeah.
So,
I was born and raised out there.
So
in fact, at that stage of the game, my wife and I still owned a farm out in Nebraska.
So you probably even visited Broken Bow, Nebraska, where Robertson was from. Or?
I don't think at that time I'd ever been in it.
Okay.
But I sure knew about it, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Did you meet the president when you became governor?
Don't think
you
so.
Were, uh-huh.
Who?
Would have been Nixon. It was still 73.
No, this wasn't a big deal for Nixon. Who was the secretary? Was it Fowler still?
Schultz.
Schultz.
Yeah, George Schultz.
Yeah. Schultz may have come over. I didn't write the president.
Uh-huh. Were your nomination hearings controversial at all, or were they not a problem?
It took a while to convince them that owning a farm in Nebraska was enough to make me justifiable to be appointed to the 10th Federal Reserve District.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that was one my wife had inherited, and I was simply, you know, co-owner because of marriage. It took a while for the lawyers to get around that one. But the hearing was a piece of cake. I mean, I'd been up there quite often, and most of the staff up in those places knew who I was and what I did, and as I recall it, one sort of senator with a bit of nastiness in mind said, you've been working for Arthur Burns these years. You're going to be a rubber stamp for him if you we elect you as the governor. And I said, I'm not in the rubber stamp business. That's about all that happened to that. But I must admit, I remembered that, Bob.
Yeah.
And I think there was, I could understand why here and there among the governors and others who would wonder, Bob's now a governor, but geez, he was Burns' right-hand man. He's probably going to do everything. Just what Burns wants. Some of that, you know, you can get around in discussions like that. So before long, I knew I was going to need to vote against Burns sometime.
Yeah.
In order to, in effect, sort of generate a sense of integrity, and
mm-hmm.
I think I even remember going down and talking to George about it. I said, I got to do something. Anyway, but I'm not sure I did. I'm not sure when I talked to him about it. Anyway, I think I kept it to myself. But I felt it. So I waited for what I felt was a juicy one, where I thought that the way the system was going was wrong, and I wanted to vote against it. And I'll tell you what it was.
Sure.
By that time, we developed this technique called swaps, which was a very efficient way of injecting reserves into and pulling back from the marketplace, you know.
Yeah.
And we were doing this, and we used this in putting pressures on exchange rates, too.
Yeah.
Because we operated then as a Treasury's arm, but there was a lot of discussion between us back and forth. And so we had swaps going.
Mm-hmm.
And they were intended to be short-term exchanges of in effect, IOUs on exchange,
yeah,
to help smooth out the exchange rate bounces some. And what was Charlie's last name?
Coombs.
The guy who ran the foreign department up in the Fed in New York, and was the operator in the exchange rate, in the exchange markets for both the Treasury and the Fed.
Charlie Coombs,
yeah. In one of those bounces, the Swiss franc was by most sensible standards misbehaving. And Charlie ran, with the blessings of the committee, ran some swaps in there to smooth things out for a while. He thought it would turn around quickly. Well, it didn't turn around quickly. And so month after month, we kept renewing these swaps to the Swiss. And I finally said, Charlie, when this FOMC created swaps, they were intended to be short time, a turnaround forces in the marketplace. And it was never intended that they were going to be long-term credits. This is supposed to be a short-term operation. And we went into it knowing that sometimes in that exchange markets, when you're dealing with those kind of things, you might lose a little money, and sometimes you might make profits and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Charlie was very proud of the fact that under his authority, the foreign exchange market and the Federal Reserve System had never lost a penny. And he hated to cash out those Swiss swaps.
Yeah, I remember there were endless discussions
about
those things. It went on and on and on. And
I got noisier and noisier and noisier about it.
Yeah.
Making the case that you, I said, Charlie, you've got a wonderful record. You're betting 1,000 this far in terms of not losing anything. But I said, you got one here that didn't do what you and the committee thought. And it ought to be, we ought to be one. These are supposed to be short-term things. It should be short-term. We should settle up short-term and go on.
Yeah.
I said, that is the rationale behind swaps. I know you hate to accept that loss, but it's going to be one loss out of 1,000 wins, Charlie. They don't let it keep hanging on. Well, Charlie had Al Hayes, who's the president of the Fed, in his lap on that, and they didn't want it. And so when it came up for a vote, I voted against rolling it over.
Hmm.
Charlie was mad, but that's all right. But Burns was hot, and I didn't know that. I thought he might be. I guess I knew he was going to be hot under the collar, because in effect I was voting against an explicit recommendation he made. He said, well, let's move these Swiss things along and see. Let's go with Charlie and see. And I think maybe one other president voted with me. I'm not sure. No, I think I was the only guy. I think I was out there all alone. But I didn't mind it, because I knew I finally had found a good case on which I could vote against Burns. And everybody would know I voted against Burns. And for a case that I thought I had analyzed correctly, and they were wrong. So I thought I'd found a way to sort of take that stigma of I'm Burns' guy off of me as a governor. So I was happy. Well, I found out later. Well, Mary Mitchell told me this long ago. She said, you know what happened after that meeting? I said, well, she said, Burns came storming down to George Mitchell's office. He was mad as... He said, George, what did you think of this? He said, you know, here I was getting... George was about ready to run out of a term at that stage, or something like it anyway. And he said, here I think I'm grooming the next vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he goes up and he votes against me. What do you think of that, George? And Mitchell was just as good as he could be. He said, I think you ought to expect it once in a while.
Oh, that's great. So when did you retire as governor?
76.
Mm-hmm.
Later on in that year. Well, not that year, but, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I went on in 73 and out in 76.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I was only a governor about 3 years. I remember what Andy Brimmer said to me when I became a governor. And he said, Bob, you're going to be the only person who ever was demoted to governor. Because he thought I had that job of executive staff planner was more powerful than any single governor. He's probably right. Well, if you look at all the things that are involved, not just monetary policy.
Yeah. I think I'd better let